Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra continues its season this weekend with their next Classics Concert featuring concertmaster Rosita Goza as soloist in Eric Korngold's Violin Concerto, Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony, the Symphony No. 3, and Samuel Barber's Medea's Dance of Vengeance rounds out this varied program, which is scheduled for Sunday afternoon at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. My guest today is the orchestra's principal guest conductor, Daniel Heggie, who will be leading the orchestra this weekend. He's also the music director of the Wichita Symphony and the principal guest conductor of the Binghamton Philharmonic in New York. He joins us to preview this weekend's concert, which is scheduled at a special time Sunday afternoon at 2:30. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rich.
And as your first program with the symphony in the new year, sort of a varied program in a way. The orchestra is very busy, by the way. They're just playing concert after concert over the last few weeks.
That's right.
And for the next few weeks. But you'll be doing one work that's very familiar to most audiences, two maybe lesser known, but the one of the two, they probably know his music in another format, and that is as a film composer, and that's Eric Korngold's Violin Concerto.
That's right. Korngold, I mean, he's really credited with really bringing or introducing a very sophisticated language into the film music, and there were many that took over from that, but it really hadn't reached that level, I think, really until he started composing there. And he said that he wanted to keep writing film music until Hitler died. as we know, I mean, he was considered, you know, what we'd say a very legitimate composer from Vienna.
He was sort of the next wave after Mahler
right.
in Vienna, right?
Yeah, he was. And if you listen to a lot of that music, I mean, it is very serious music, and it sounds a lot like even like Richard Strauss and Mahler. Mm-hmm. So extremely talented, genius composer. And then when he immigrated to the United States, found his niche in Hollywood. And so he helped create that sound. And like I said, wanted to do that until after Second World War.
And for those that don't know his film music, if you've seen any swashbuckler or any adventure film from the 1930s with Errol Flynn, chances are Eric Korngold did the music for it.
Right.
The Adventures of Robin Hood. There's a number of swashbucklers.
Captain Blood.
Yeah, exactly.
They're Seahawk. I mean, there are a lot of great films that he did. And the music might actually eclipse the film a little bit itself. Shortly then after Hitler died, he did want to return back to writing for the concert hall. And this was the first piece that he wrote after that. So it was in 1946 he started writing it. It was premiered in 1947. Yasha Heifetz made it very famous. He introduced the work with the St. Louis Symphony when its premiere, and then later played it in Carnegie Hall. And it was basically Heifetz launched that piece into its popularity.
What is special about it?
It is so rich and so lush and is so melodic. And the way he writes for the orchestra, it's so intricate. And yet, as a listener, you just have this beautiful, wash and blending of the instruments. And yet it's written in such a way that sometimes one instrument will come in and then back away and just add a little bit of color, a little celeste, maybe one little comment from the harp, and then maybe just bass clarinet here and so on. And it's really a fascinating work that way, almost kaleidoscopic in orchestral color. And then it's so virtuosic for the violinist. And Rosita Goza, our concertmaster, is playing the solo part, and she is doing just a brilliant job, as we all knew that she would. And so the virtuosity of the violin part, along with the orchestrational color, makes this piece lovable for the very first time that you hear it.
You mentioned that Heifetz sort of launched the piece, but it was actually written for Heifetz as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. He had him in mind, and of course, Heifetz is someone who would have been up to those technical demands of the piece.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about what's particularly difficult about this piece for a violinist?
Well, it's just the sheer pyrotechnics of getting around. I mean, just simply even learning the notes, because the notes, I want to say they're awkward, although Rosita doesn't make them sound awkward. She makes it sound like it's almost easy for her to play this music. But it is just, you know, it's very high. There are huge leaps, and the harmony is just such that it's not always expected where it's going. And so that makes it very difficult. And there's always a sense of rubato and freedom. And so the tempos are not always staying exactly lockstep. So to have that kind of flexibility and to get the sound just right to blend with the orchestra, it's quite a challenge.
Now, you mentioned the fact that there's a lot of rubato, a lot of almost colla voce, but except with a colla violin,
yes.
If you will. Is that some of the hardest stuff to put together for an orchestra and a conductor, especially one that's not, you know, you see them three or four times a year, but it's not like you're the music director and they're seeing you all the time.
Right.
Is that some of the hardest things for an orchestra and a soloist to get together?
Well, sometimes. I think in this particular case, if I really know what she's doing and I can show that from the podium and I can be very clear, because there are a lot of meter changes and things like that too, the orchestra can really follow pretty well. And they did a great job last night. We worked on it last night, so it was very exciting. I think it's going to come together quite quickly. But yeah, that is always a challenge when it's very free like that.
Korngold, in this piece, he, like many other composers before him, was not above recycling old material. In fact, there's a number of musical themes and cues from his film scores from the previous decade of work in Hollywood that are a part of this. But I don't get the sense this is really has a film music feel
no.
to it.
No, it doesn't have a film.
It's maybe motifs,
right.
is what you're really hearing from some of those film scores.
Right. And I, you know, as I mentioned earlier, he was such a bona fide composer in his own right. So he knew how to write with motivic invention and then build form and structure out of it, just like any other very well-schooled and well-educated composer could. And so when he took some of the themes from his earlier movies, he would simply use them as kind of building blocks, and then he would work out variation and everything in the same way that any scholarly composer would. So it does come off as, I mean, some people might think it's a hybrid. It's like, well, it sounds like film music. It's like, well, no, it's the other way around. I mean, he's a legitimate composer that wrote for film, and so now you can't say it's the other way around. It isn't like he borrowed from the film school way of writing music. But he actually takes some of those ideas and motives from things like, you know, in the first movement, he uses music from a movie, Another Dawn. And from the second movement, he uses Anthony Adverse, that film. Yeah. And the third one, Prince and the Pauper. So he uses those three films with those motifs, and then he builds and makes an actual bona fide concerto with form and structure.
Yeah. Well, why don't we hear a little bit of that last movement? This is probably the most popular film of the ones you mentioned that Korngold did the score for. And, you know, you might hear just a tiny bit of Prince and the Pauper, but not much, really.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. Here's the final movement, and this is Yasha Heifetz from that first recording.
Oh, great.
So here is the music of Korngold, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra at a special time, Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the
Tulsa Performing. That is right. That's important.
Tulsa Performing Arts Center with Rosica Jakova Goza as soloist. Here's the music by Korngold. That's the music of Eric Korngold, the violin concerto, one of the featured works for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in their next concert, also featuring the music of Samuel Barber and Felix Mendelssohn. My guest is conductor and principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony, Daniel Heggie. And that is not the only work that you don't hear as often, and the other work is also an amazing piece.
Mm-hmm.
Has amazing harmonic language. It also uses a motif that keeps returning in different guises throughout its 12 or 13 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's Samuel Barber's Medea's Dance of Vengeance.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about this piece.
Well, this piece was written really as a ballet. So it started as a ballet, as Medea. And then he later wanted to extract seven movements and make it kind of a suite of all of the, kind of a breakdown of it, so it could be performed as a concert suite. And then he later said, I'm going to boil it down to a single movement and just get the essence of the work. And that's what we're playing, the Dance of Vengeance, which actually was earlier called Meditation and Dance of Vengeance. And you can see why that works also, because the first part of it, maybe even the first 8 minutes out of the 12 or 13 minutes, is really kind of meditative. And it's kind of brewing. You can see something is going to happen. I mean, this story is really awful. I mean, it's kind of like a Greek tragedy, you know. So Medea is this woman married to Jason, and, you know, she finds out he's having these affairs and everything, and it really troubles her very much, and she wants to avenge him in a way.
And we should mention the ballet, the story with the ballet is very different than the classic Greek myth, where Medea is this ugly, ugly thing that Jason ends up killing, and
right,
you know,
it is different than that.
It's very different than this. It's more of a relationship and love gone wrong ballet.
Right, exactly right. Because when it starts off, he has them actually as mythical creatures, and then they kind of enter in a more of a modern situation, and then at the end they go back into this mythical kind of side, and so. Barber didn't seem as interested in just kind of creating a depiction of everything that's happening, but more to project kind of these timeless emotions that people have, jealousy and rage and vengeance. And that's what we hear at the beginning, is that these kind of tender feelings that Medea has for her children. It's very pastoral and open. And then trouble starts to move in, and this is where she has suspicions and doubts and this kind of brewing of what's going to go wrong. And you can hear that in the music kind of evolve or devolve into this darker place. And then we eventually, maybe about 8 minutes into this, break into this dance where she's avenged. And it's awful because she, in order to get her husband back, she kills her children to hurt him and kills the woman he's having an affair with. I'm like, okay, do not cross this woman. if you know it's good for you. So we get into this frenzy. You know, it's full of mixed meter to create that sort of tension. And it has, Barber writes throughout the score toward the end when this frenzied dance is going on to play with a very biting sound. I mean, you don't see that often in music, but he actually asks the brass to do that, you know, and they have a muted sound. It sounds kind of evil. And woodwinds as well to have this very sarcastic cutting sound. And then it has this almost kind of glorious ending, and then again ends with this frenzied dance. It's a very dramatic piece, and it's very, very exciting to do. And it's important for people to know this is a story, okay? This didn't happen. So, you know, people hear that, oh, that's so dark. It's like, it's a story. It's a story, okay? So let's not take it too seriously.
But you mentioned that he does use elements from this whole 30 or 40 minute ballet.
Yeah.
And condenses it down to, you know, less than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You might think, well, it's a little episodic. And it is, but at the same time, his masterful writing, he manages to make those seams fit, you know, hand in glove.
It's amazing because you actually feel like the composition is so organic. Like whatever episode starts to happen next, when it becomes much more agitated, it just comes right out of what happened before. You don't feel like, okay, now we've ended that emotion or that movement, and now we're moving into this movement. It's like it naturally follows. It just simply evolves into the next part. And that's the sign of a brilliant composer. And Samuel Barber is right up there with the greatest because, like you mentioned earlier, he uses the motives from very early on when the music is slow, and he brings it back in the fast section. He does that in his violin concerto as well. He does it in many of his works. Many people know Barber from the Adagio for Strings, which is very slow singing music, and there is a lot of that kind of soaring lyricism in this piece as well, but he has just a rhythmic aspect to the music that is just propulsive all the way through, and I think people will just be trying to catch their breath at the end.
What's the biggest challenge of playing his music?
In the fast section, the issue can just be simply ensemble. And what I've done is I've taken the piano, the orchestral piano part. It's not a solo piano part, but it's an integral part to bringing everyone together. I actually place him in the middle of the orchestra, which is a little unusual, and I take the lid off. And that is because oftentimes the piano is thumping out in a very percussive way the rhythmic energy that everyone else needs to feed off of. And so that's the issue, I think, in the fast section, but the orchestra is just nailing it. I mean, they're doing an amazing job. In the slow section, it's about connecting the long lines and making it feel as organic as possible.
Yeah. When you mentioned the violin concerto and the piano concerto, those are fiendishly difficult. Is it the same for this orchestral piece? Because it certainly sounds difficult.
It is. It's very virtuosic for the orchestra as a whole, and there are certain parts of it that are very challenging for each of the instruments in the orchestra, especially in the fast section. It has those kinds of challenges. Barber doesn't spare anything. I mean, his music is difficult. It always is.
Well, let's hear a little of music from the Medea's Dance of Vengeance. This is that fast section you were talking about. This is with the St. Louis Symphony and Leonard Slatkin. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, who will be leading the Tulsa Symphony in the Barber work this Sunday at 2:30. Here's the music of Barber. Music from Samuel Barber's Medea's Dance of Vengeance, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Sunday afternoon at 2:30. We should mention it's not the usual Saturday nighttime, Sunday at 2:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. My guest is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony.
Yeah, and that 2:30 time, it's going to be a perfect setup for people who want to watch the Super Bowl. It'll be like, how you want to get fired up for the Super Bowl that evening, come out to the concert.
Listen to a little Medea's Dance of Vengeance.
Yeah, get you revved up a little bit, and then go watch the game and the commercials, of course.
The final work is probably the most popular piece of the three on the program, and this is one of those times when, having a symphony number is perhaps not the best vehicle for describing where this happened in Felix Mendelssohn's life. It's the Symphony No. 3. It's known as the Scottish Symphony. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's the best way to refer to it, as the Scottish Symphony, because it's not really the third symphony he wrote.
No, he actually wrote it as his fifth symphony. I mean, we know his five symphonies, but Reformation Symphony is called, is the fifth symphony, and the fourth is Italian, and so on. But yeah, it ended up that he published it third. So that's sometimes where this gets confused. So he actually wrote it last, but he actually started it quite early. Yeah. So it had a long gestation. He started writing in 1829. In his only early 20s or something like that. It was just a few days before he actually wrote Hebrides, because he was in Scotland and he was seeing all these beautiful sights, and saw this wonderful palace of Queen Mary and the ruins and how the heavens were pouring through. And he says, I have an idea for a Scottish symphony. So he's in his early 20s. And then a few days later, he goes off the coast of Staffa, where he gets inspired to write the Hebrides Overture. And he finished that quite quickly. But then as he worked on the Scottish Symphony, he kept working and reworking it, and maybe he wasn't satisfied. So he put it aside and started working on the other symphonies, and then came back to it about 13 years later, the Scottish Symphony, and then he finished it. It's interesting why that is, but you can hear that musical sophistication all the way through. I mean, Mendelssohn has such a poetic way about his music, and it combines many of the qualities of Mozart and classicism, but also with this kind of looking forward in a very romantic kind of way. And of course, he's known for using pictorial images and literature to inspire him to write music.
What I love about this piece is, yes, it does have this long gestation period, and it's his most mature symphony. But at the same time, you hear moments that remind you of what a Wunderkind he was as a young, There are moments that very much remind you of Midsummer Night's Dream, which was written when he was 17 years old.
I know.
It was as a teenager. And there are moments that have that same sort of youthful vigor.
Yeah, it's true. Like, the scherzo, for example, the second movement really has that kind of quality. It almost sounds naive and beautiful. And actually, of the four movements, that you might say that it sounds the most like Scottish music, folk music in a sense. It starts in A minor and has kind of a brooding quality at the beginning, but so gorgeous. Anyone would just be kind of sucked right into that sound. And then it goes into kind of allegro of the first movement, but still stays in A minor. So it has this brooding quality. We talked about the second movement a little bit. It's F major. It's very upbeat, kind of just loving life. And then we get to a more somber third movement, which is almost a feeling of not tragedy, but a little bit of longing in it. And then we get to the fourth movement, which is also in A minor. And then it has this interesting ending, which after everything kind of pauses and very quiet, it's like a coda. We just have this small section of the end, which is very majestic, very noble, a sound that Mendelssohn is known for, almost an aristocratic quality to it. And it's in A major. And what's interesting is I was reading about this, and a number of people, of course, Schumann loved that symphony, and they both liked each other's music a lot. But contemporary scholars have been a little bit critical of it to say, why does he have a happy ending? It starts in this brooding A minor, and then at the end we have this A major. And in fact, Otto Klemperer, I was reading this, disliked the ending so much that he refused to do it. So he wrote his own ending was in A minor.
Well, that's...
I thought, really? Then just don't do the piece if you don't like it. But of course, I guess there were some conductors that just felt like they were entitled to do that.
When you think of Mendelssohn's music, you think of it as essentially happy music.
Yeah. It starts in A minor and ends in A major, but there's so much precedent set for that already in music, because we see Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, for example, Ninth Symphony. You look at Brahms' First Symphony, and it ends with, it begins with such a tumultuous C minor sound and ends in blazing C major. So I don't really see what the issue would be for contemporary people, someone like Otto Klemperer, to be in the 20th century and knowing all of that, and then saying, why is it ending happy? It's like, because a lot of composers have done that, and it makes sense. A lot of symphonies actually carry us on an emotional journey that sometimes can start from a darker place and then end up with jubilation and victory. And that's a very common kind of thing. If you think of literature, films, plays, anything, they create a tension, because that's what makes it interesting, is we see two forces pushing against each other, and then who's going to win in the end? And obviously Mendelssohn felt like this is the best way to end it. It ends with such majesty and victory.
When I think of the most telling example, it's the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven. Mm-hmm. What would you do without a C major ending?
Right,
ending
right.
Of a C minor symphony.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it is. It's maybe the greatest example. But there really are so many. And so I think this is a glorious piece, one of the most glorious. And just especially that last part is just filled with such optimism. And even his tragic sound, it's an A minor and dark. It's just, I don't know, it's almost intoxicating, the sound.
Now, when we think of the Scottish Symphony and the Italian Symphony, we think of his trips to each of those locales. But how much is that really influencing the music you hear, do you think?
I definitely think that it can be overstated, I think, to people. In fact, commentators have mentioned that if people try to hold on to that too much, the subtitle of a symphony, that sometimes they miss out on actually the qualities, the musical qualities of the work. And it was known that even Mendelssohn with the Scottish Symphony, although he had written this at the very beginning and said, wow, I just saw this great castle and I have this inspiration to write this symphony, in later years, he de-emphasized that and he did not call attention to the Scottish aspect of the piece. And I think that's consistent with a lot of composers, that even if they use a program, they might mention it at some point, but they don't want to dwell on that, because then the observer is sitting there trying to force the music into some sort of program, and that's not what it's about. It's not depicting something literally. It is showing the inspiration that they gained from that.
Although that might come later in music history with, Strauss and various other composers, they are depicting a program.
They are depicting a program, but even Richard Strauss. There were people who say, "Can we write in a program that follows what's going on?" And he said, "Well, okay." Even he was reluctant to do that sometimes. And there are a number of famous conductors today, and I think of Daniel Barenboim especially, who says, I don't even want to know the program to anything I'm conducting, even if there's an explicit program. I don't want to have to conduct a piece so that it makes sense in the program for the listener. So I'm going to conduct the piece the way the music is. And if it fits into the person's idea of what the program is, that's good for them.
Is that your approach?
It is very much, actually. I try to look at the essence of the music itself, and I don't try to read into extra musical aspects. I think if the music requires, I'm saying requires, the program in order to succeed, I think it's lesser music. Mm. It is lesser music if it requires it. Now, if it adds to it and the music is already successful, then I think it's okay.
Yeah. Why don't we hear a little bit of Mendelssohn before our time is up? This is from the symphony, the Scottish Symphony, the Symphony No. 3 by Mendelssohn. Here's that scherzo movement we were talking about a moment ago.
Great.
Music by Mendelssohn, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Special time for this weekend's concert with Daniel Heggie, principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. Well, it sounds like a really great program. You'll be home before the Super Bowl, right?
Yes, you'll be home before kickoff, you know, so enjoy. Please come out. Yeah.
Well, Daniel, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rich.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He leads the orchestra in a program featuring the music of Korngold, the violin concerto with Rosita Goza, the concertmaster of the orchestra, a soloist, Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony, and Samuel Barber's Medea's Dance of Vengeance. The program is scheduled for Sunday afternoon at 2:30. That's a special time this weekend at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. You can learn details at tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.